Now, thinking about creativity, it occurs to me that in an early talk I spoke of mind creative and mind reactive. I think most of you have heard this talk on tape or read it in the little book that has now come out called Buddha Mind. I've described creative mind as being the mind that is independent, the mind that is spontaneous, the mind that is aware. And in the same way, I've described the reactive mind as the mind that is reactive, that doesn't originate anything, that just reacts. And the reactive mind is therefore the dependent mind. It is the repetitive mind. It is the mechanical mind. I've gone into all this, I think, in some detail in this particular talk and perhaps on other occasions. But thinking about these things, it occurred to me recently that I could add another characteristic or epithet to the reactive mind. That the reactive mind is not just reactive, not just repetitive, not just mechanical, not even just unaware. It's something else. The reactive mind is not just non-creative. The reactive mind can be anti-creative. The reactive mind can be destructive. And this put me in mind of something I'd been reading recently, or rather, something to which I had been listening recently on cassette. And this was to Ted Hughes' translation and reading of that great old English or Anglo-Saxon epic, Beowulf. I don't know how many people are familiar with Beowulf, but it's well worth being familiar with. And is illustrative of what I'm talking about now, or of a certain aspect of it. The poem, it seems, as far as I can make out, was written down in the 10th century. I believe there's only one surviving manuscript. But it seems it was composed, perhaps orally, in about the 8th century, and relates to happenings which probably occurred in the 5th or 6th century, as far as I can make out. As scholars probably differ, from one another on all these points. And the story of the epic, at least the first half of the epic, is set in, it seems, what is now Denmark. And it begins with a description of the descent of the then king of the Danes. The Danes, it seems, were called Scyldings for some reason or other. And the poem relates, I think, four or five or more generations of kings, down to the king who was reigning at the time of this particular story. The king, it seems, was very famous. He attracted many young men into his service. He was a just ruler. He accumulated great riches. And one day he decided to build a magnificent hall. And he sent for architects and artists from all over the world. This couldn't have been very historical, but anyway, this is what the poem says. Perhaps we'll see the significance of this in a moment. And this great hall was built, this enormous hall. And the poem describes it as a wonder of the world. And it describes how it was adorned inside and outside with gold. And it glittered, from afar. It was the most magnificent building at that time in the whole world, we are told. So clearly, the building, this great hall, comes to have a sort of, we might say, even archetypal significance. And it's referred to as a mead hall, the hall in which the warriors, you know, gathered to drink mead, to rejoice, to celebrate. And we're also told that when this hall was inaugurated, the first time it was used, when the king was there with all his men, the queen was there, the minstrel started singing, the court poet, so to speak, started singing, and his song was of creation, the creation of the sun and the moon, the creation of the earth and of all living things. So it seems to me, the first time I read, because it was many years ago, the first time I read this poem, when I came to this passage, I felt, well, here is something of great archetypal significance. It's almost as though this great hall, adorned with gold that the king has built, represents the whole structure of civilization and culture, of the whole of humanity. It's what we've built up, the values that we've created over the centuries since the dawn of history. It seems to me to have that sort of significance. So the story goes on that there was great feasting and rejoicing in the hall. And everyone was pleased, everyone was happy. I say everyone, but there was someone who was not happy. Someone who didn't like to see that great hall, who didn't like to hear the rejoicing, didn't like to hear the song of the minstrel. And that was a demon, a monster, called Grendel. Now, I don't know what the word Grendel, the name Grendel, means, but it has a very harsh sound. To my mind, it has a sound as of the gnashing or grinding of teeth. Grendel. Yeah? So Grendel, this demon, this monster, who is described as being descended from Cain, who murdered his brother Abel in the Old Testament, this monster was not at all happy to hear the feasting and the singing. So one night he crept up, he broke down the door of the hall, and he slaughtered 30 of the men who were sleeping there that night and took them away to eat them, to devour them. So after that, night after night, he came and pillaged and wrecked that hall, so that, it became deserted. People could not feast, could not make merry there, could not hear the song of the minstrel there anymore. There's just another, a little significant detail. The hall was also the throne room of the king, and we're told, in a rather mysterious way, that Grendel was kept from the throne. Now, that has, I'm sure, a deep significance that I may go into it some other time, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. But we're told that for 12 years, Grendel was visiting that hall and despoiling it so that it could not be used. And word of this spread, you know, quite widely throughout the area, spread even to distant countries. And again, to cut a long story short, the hero Beowulf comes from the land of the Geats, which seems to be not very far away, perhaps in southern Sweden, and he and his men sleep in that hall. Grendel comes, he kills one man, but then he comes to Beowulf, and Beowulf has in his hands the strength of 30 men. So he seizes Grendel's arm and doesn't let go, and Grendel is so desperate to get away that, he leaves his arm behind. Beowulf wrenches it off. So, again, there is feasting and there is music and there is singing in the hall. But that's not the end of the story, because Grendel has a mother. We're not told her name. She's just referred to as Grendel's mother. And she lives where Grendel also used to live, at the bottom of a deep, dark pool, in the midst of a very sinister sort of forest, away up in the mountains. So she is, you know, very upset that her son has lost his arm and died as a result. So she comes again to the hall, and she snatches away the king's close friend and favorite advisor, and then she gets away before Beowulf can catch hold of her. So what the next morning Beowulf and the king, they follow her track, and they discover, you know, this deep, this black lake overshadowed by rocks and trees deep in the forest, and Beowulf plunges down into the depths where he kills Grendel's mother. So this is, I'm dwelling a little on some details, but I think there is some significance. Grendel is defeated in the hall. He comes to the hall and he's defeated there. But in order to defeat Grendel's mother, Beowulf has to track her and go down into those depths, as though she represents a force even more primordial than Grendel himself. So I'm mentioning this. I'm dwelling on this episode in the story of Beowulf, and this is only half the story, by the way. There's another half where Beowulf fights and kills a dragon and is killed himself at the same time 50 years later. So I'm using this just as an illustration, as it were, of the fact that the reactive mind can be destructive. Grendel, we can say, represents or even symbolizes or embodies that aspect of the reactive mind which is not only not creative but is even opposed to creativity. And we can see this operating on or within all the different fields of creativity which I've mentioned.